two moments stand out for me in the story of the Greensboro Four. The moment when the four young men decide to do the sit-in, not just discuss the possibility of doing a sit-in in some vague way, but decide that they will actually go to Woolworth in Greensboro and sit at the counter until served or arrested or worse. And the other moment, when they sit on the stools at the lunch counter, the actual act of sitting. In each of those moments, these four young men acted with deep conviction and courage. They chose to do something that mattered. They chose, as one said later, to no longer be armchair activists. Sitting down was risky, and it was scary, and it was hard. Emmett Till was their age. When they were all 15 years old, Till had been beaten to death because some white people thought he had broken the rules that controlled white and black life together. The young men had seen the pictures of Till afterwards. They knew what was possible. Now they were actually going to break the rules that governed white and black life together. Theodore Roosevelt once said, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly." I have spent a good deal of time considering those moments when those four college freshmen decided to dare greatly, take a huge risk, and be the people that they most wanted to be. Why do sometimes people decide to dare greatly and other times curl protectively inward to act and show their hearts to the world? These decisions are not just made in extraordinary moments, but in our ordinary lives, more frequently than we probably even pay attention to. We are given those choices when faced with the situations described in this morning's reading. Will I say hello to the stranger standing awkwardly in the sanctuary door? Will I stay connected to Miguel when he just voted against my idea? Will I acknowledge the tug on my heart and wallet that asked me to really wrestle with the amount of my pledge? Will I or will I not risk the feeling of being unsure and uninformed as I step outside my comfort zone and spend time with those of other races, classes, or generations on their terms rather than mine? Will I expose my need for wholeness, my hope for forgiveness, my longing to belong, and my desire to matter? I have confronted many of these moments in my own life. The moment when I have had to choose between being the person I want to be and my discomfort or my fear. Moments when I could speak hard truths or placate someone's feelings. Moments when I could show up or stay home. Moments when I could follow my deepest truth or simply go along with a crowd. Moments when I could follow my deepest truth and choose kindness or ask for my heart or my angry feelings. Many of these moments I don't remember. They are just the stuff of ordinary life. But other moments I remember well. The decision moments exist in my memory as white, blank patches. I know now what I did in each of those circumstances, but my memory still keeps a record of the actual decision moment, when I could have done one thing or another thing. I believe this is because they were powerful, turning moments. If I did one thing, my life would go one way. If I did another, my life would go a different way. They were moments of personal transformation. My choice created the person that I was becoming. Whether I chose to speak my truth, participate in nonviolent protest, reach out to strangers, continue a relationship through painful disagreement, or not, change who I was. I remember one such moment years ago when my sons were young and they played soccer. One of their coaches was a good coach, very intense, but very good. He clearly loved the team, and he made them work hard. And he did things like challenge the team when they were winning to help a player who never scored to score. And I really admired him. But one day, I showed up at practice, and he was shouting at a boy to stop kicking like a girl. And I felt completely chilled. He was telling the boys that being like a girl was bad and that girls were inferior. This was absolutely unacceptable. I decided I had to talk to him about it. I carefully planned my script. Each practice I went intending to talk to him. Each time I went home with a task unaccomplished. What stopped me was the fear of his reaction. This was really intense. And the potential of a ruined relationship. When I imagined talking to him, I felt the discomfort of doing something I imagined would probably end badly. How did that affect who I was? I felt like an ineffectual person who lacked the ability to stand up for what I believed in. I felt less able to talk to people about sexism, racism, and classism. I struggled mightily to dare greatly. Many of us have had moments of doing what we really wanted to do, of not doing what we do with the right thing. Often what stops us is fear. We fear the discomfort of shaking up our lives. We fear embarrassment, humiliation, shaming, and pain. We fear the loss of livelihood and security. We fear the loss of love or belonging. We fear not having control. We fear uncertainty. In fact, studies have shown that we fear uncertainty more than we fear pain. We will make all kinds of choices because we fear suffering or discomfort or uncertainty. We will hold on to our addictions knowing they might kill us or destroy our relationships. Because the suffering caused by ending the addiction is so uncomfortable, so miserable, and so unfamiliar that it is unbearable to consider. We will stay in an abusive relationship when we know we should leave, because we know this particular suffering and how to endure it. The suffering we imagine if we leave, homelessness or loneliness, or loss of status, are unknowable, and thus, feel unbearable. We will not speak the truth because we fear the shaming and the loss of love and belonging. We will stay an armchair activist because we fear embarrassment or humiliation or failure. We created modern societies to reduce and end discomfort and suffering and uncertainty. We, the medical and psychological professions, exist to end suffering. We have agriculture to ensure we are never hungry. We have built homes that make sure we are not too cold or too hot. We have drugs to reduce pain and the itch of rashes and the effects of congestion and fever. We have created religions and philosophies intended to reduce the discomfort of uncertainty. We often develop aversions and fear to anything that will make us uncomfortable, uncertain, or potentially cause suffering. And this is just how we are. It's nothing to be ashamed of or add to your guilt list. However, this ingrained tendency does get in the way of honoring our own truth and living our values. So what do? Where do we get the courage to overcome all that we are afraid of? Shame and vulnerability researcher Brené Brown argues that courage comes from the act of embracing the tender, gentle part of ourselves that wants to be loved and wants to love and let that part of us be seen. Courage is the act of being seen and being vulnerable. Vulnerability is not weakness, she writes, and the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure we face every single day are not optional. Our only choice is a question of engagement. Our willingness to own and engage with our vulnerability determines the depth of our courage and the clarity of our purpose. The level to which we protect ourselves from being vulnerable is a measure of our fear of disconnection. Brown says that to live fully from our hearts, we must discover our own worthiness. We must speak our shame and fears to those who love us best of all, because shame and fear wither in the light. We must make friends with ourselves and that which we fear the most. The fear of shame and the loss of love and belonging and of embarrassment and humiliation become fears we can manage and endure. Tina Chodron also says that to act courageously, you must make friends with yourself and also with your fear. Fear is not something to be lamented, avoided, or vanquished, she says. It is something to be examined, something to make a relationship with. Fear catches our attention, she says. This is a good thing. Usually where there is fear, there is power. But when faced with fear, we are tempted to put on our armor and protect ourselves from what we fear. This only creates more suffering. Instead, we must get to know our fears and be respectful of them. What are they teaching us? I learned to be friends with my fear of discomfort in yoga class. For several years, I took yoga from a yoga teacher who was always correlating our response to yoga with a response to life. We started her class with yin yoga, which is a form of yoga where you get into the stretching pose and hang out for like 5 minutes or eternity or something like that. The stretch would start out feeling really nice, as they often do, and then this burning would start. And at first it was just uncomfortable, but it would quickly become very painful. Not that the yoga teacher used perfectly accurate words like painful. She preferred the word sensation, as in the sensation might be getting intense just now. Then she would ask about our reactions to this intense sensation. Did we want to run away from it? Did it challenge us? Did we want to fight it? Our reaction was probably similar to our reaction to discomfort in life, she told us. And she asked to notice if that was true. I found out quickly that I was a running from discomfort kind of person. When I first started the class, when I got that searing sensation, I would just quit. Life is too short. Why hurt? Was my basic attitude. I noticed in life as well that my tendency was to try to make uncomfortable situations as comfortable as possible, as quickly as possible. It was no wonder that I did not dare greatly and talk to my son's soccer coach. The teacher kept pressing us, though. So what if we chose not to run and just noticed the sensation instead? What if we just paid attention to it? What were its qualities? Did it feel differently in different places, at different times, in different legs? Did it change? And slowly I learned to hang out with this excruciating sensation by simply paying attention to it. Without really trying, I found this practice transforming my life. I lost much of my fear of discomfort. When a situation got uncomfortable, instead of quickly trying to make it more comfortable, I could just hang out and pay attention. Why was it uncomfortable? What would happen if I didn't fix it? What would happen if I stepped into it? After that, those moments of decision arrived where I wanted to speak my truth or live my values, I found I wasn't as afraid of the discomfort or the possibility of suffering. I had learned another way to manage those types of feelings. Tina Chodron tells a beautiful story about a young warrior. The teacher told her that she had to do battle with fear, and she didn't want to. It seemed too aggressive. It was scary. It seemed unfriendly. But the teacher said she had to do it and gave her instructions for the battle. The day arrived. The student warrior stood on one side and fear stood on the other. The warrior was feeling very small. and Fear was looking big and wrathful. They both had their weapons. The young warrior roused herself and went toward Fear, prostrating 3 times, and asked, "May I ask permission to go into battle with you?" Fear said, "Thank you for showing me so much respect that you asked permission." The young warrior asked, "How can I defeat you?" Fear replied, "My weapons are that I talk fast and I get very close to your face. When you get completely unnerved, then you do whatever I say. If you don't do what I tell you, I have no power. You can listen to me. You can have respect for me. You can even be convinced by me. But if you don't do what I say, you have no power." In that way, the student warrior learned how to defeat Fear. The Green Squirrel 4 were close friends. They shared their frustration and anger with each other. They shared their hopes and aspirations. They shared the shame and humiliation that Southern culture had burdened them with. They fought for the sham that it was. And then they made friends with their fear. They knew their fear. They knew the real dangers that it pointed to. They were afraid of being beaten, of spending months in jail, or losing their ability to be successful students and thus have successful lives. They knew the dangers of not acting as well. Joe McNeil simply could no longer bear the humiliation. Frank McCain had spent years on the edge of committing suicide as a teenager because of his degrading existence as a black person in the South. They all knew the shame and disrespect that their loved ones and other black people experienced. They knew their fear. They looked at it. It got close to their faces and talked really fast and really loud. Azelle felt its sweat roll down his neck. They felt it in their bellies. But they also looked past the fear at what it might mean to insist on their own inherent worth and dignity. They did not do what their fear told them to do. They dared greatly. They entered the ring of the arena. Later, every one of them said that sitting down at that lunch counter was the most powerful moment of their lives. 15 seconds after I sat on that stool, McCain said later, "I had the most wonderful feeling. I had a feeling of liberation, restored manhood. I had a natural high, and I truly felt almost invincible. It's a feeling I don't think that I'll ever be able to have again. It's the kind of thing that people pray for and wish for all their lives and never experience. And I felt as though I wouldn't have been cheated out of life had that been the end of my life at that second and that moment." And that is what we all want, isn't it? To be powerful in our own truth and embody what we most value and care about. The Greensboro 4 and so many others, those who say hello to the stranger at the door, who stay in a relationship when it is hard, who drink their last drink, apologize for hurting someone, who give what they want to give instead of what is prudent, who say, "I love you," and they don't really know if they're loved back. All those people and so many others show it is possible to live our truth and our values and be the people that we most want to be. May we open our hearts so we know just how lovable and worthy each one of us is, for we are truly remarkable. May we learn how to bow to fear with respect and to sit kindly with discomfort and suffering. May we look behind that gesturing, wild fear to what matters most. May we dare greatly.
Jesus, the Duca. My oldest, Philip the Duca, is in a quandary. Not a big problem, but just he's feeling the pressure of doing a teen youth service, something like that, and he feels like I don't want to do it. You know, there's all the other teams have quit. They're not coming anymore. You know, it's like falling on my shoulders and these two other guys. We don't know what to do. Do we really have to play music? Do we really have to read a poem? Do we really have to do this? There's all these expectations, and I wish they heard your sermon today. I really do, because there's some fear. You know, there's some worry, and it's amazing to me anytime the youth come up, and I'm so filled with pride. I know how afraid and how uncertain they are, and I just want to thank them every time that they do, because that was me trying to find my courage.
I think this kind of directly relates. My mom has been my grandmother's primary caregiver for several years, and they had a tumultuous relationship. And okay, my mom was able to tell my grandma she loved her, but my grandma never said it. She would brag about my mom to other people, but never say it. And just 2 nights ago, my mom called me, and she's crying, and she said that grandma, right before she was put on morphine, said, "I love you." And she had, you know, was only saying a couple words here and there. So my mom, at the last bit of talking, got some resolve. Oh, that's really great.
For the story of the Greensboro Four was for me, I'm probably still hung up there. In 1963, I was president of the Oregon Future Farmers of America and was attending the National Future Farmers Conference in Kansas City, Missouri. I was with three of my very dearest friends, who were the presidents of the Washington Association, the California Association, and the Mexico Association. The four of us went out to have dinner. The president of the California Association was black. He was the first black man that I ever knew, first black man that I ever talked about. I was an Oregonian growing up in the Rogue River Valley, which was tightly controlled by the KKK, and we didn't have black people there. So the four of us went out for dinner, went into a nice restaurant in Kansas City, and I walked up to the hostess and said, "A table for four." And she said, "I can't serve him." And I said, "What?" She said, "I can't serve him." I said, "Who can't you serve?" And then she said, "Him," followed by the N-word. Many of you know that I tend to respond pretty rapidly. And my anger flared, and I was in her face instantly. And the manager of the restaurant came over and said to me, "If you don't leave, I will call the police." And I said something along the lines of, "Go ahead and call the police." And I raised my fist to engage him. Dan, the black man, grabbed me and said, "This isn't the time. This is white." That has obviously been heavy on my heart the entire time, the entire life. And I still regret what I did and what I didn't do. Thank you, Chris.
Relating to, there's a theme in your talk that I'm struggling to find a word for, but what relates to it is my gratitude for my friends who were able to go out and protest when I wasn't available to do that. Just the fact that they took action. And I have a dear friend who's actually a former student of mine, and another dear friend who has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair, and the two of them were both caught in the tear gas that was used by the police in Portland a few weeks back. And they were okay the next day, but it was really rough. And I was really concerned about my friends with CP, because any compromising in breathing is really dangerous. And I'm just really grateful to them and my other friends and other members of the community for finding the courage to go out and protest
with all the other women marchers during that event.
It's always, it feels like when people around us are courageous, it makes it easier for us to be courageous, I think.
Good morning. And for a long time, when I'm come up against the situation where I feel a lot of fear, I rely on a phrase from a guy named Ralph Waldo Emerson. He might know.
I've heard of him once.
And it sort of summarizes everything he said today. And the phrase is simply, the power is in the doing. Mm-hmm. Once you do it, you've got the power.
Right. Ignore fear. Right. Exactly. So my... But I don't know if any of you have seen The Real People Cinderella, which came out a couple years ago. But what Cinderella's mother tells her is to always be kind and always be courageous, which sometimes is my just simple mantra about what how it is that I want to be human in the world, which kind of fit with the song today. So I just thought that was really great.
Thank you, Tracy. I'm here. Doing something is so, it makes you feel very powerful. And years ago, when I picked this, anyway, I felt so powerful to it.
Hi, I'm just remembering my mother. She was born in Chillicothe, Ohio, and she was a little girl when she saw all the Ku Klux Klan members marching around in their white outfits. And even as a little girl, she thought how ridiculous they looked, posing around, these grown men in these white sheets. And, you know, she was right. She never forgot it and always remembered how silly these people were and how closed-minded.
And it's interesting. They were too afraid to show who they were. Pretty much.
So at Parade Magazine last week, this thing on kindness, and the front of it was throw kindness around like confetti. And I never discussed that.
Okay.
One thing I'm struggling with is how to own my fear and my anger and my truth and speak in a way that the conservative can hear me. Like if I was speaking to the Ku Klux Klan, how do I speak around the white law to what they're afraid of? So how do I have a relationship that you talked about with that fear and anger and then the kindness, because everybody's afraid. I mean, the conservatives, and obviously Donald Trump, are afraid. How can I not continue the paradigm that's going on of extreme, I'm losing the word, but two-side polarities that speaks to them in a way that recognizes that fear and my fear.
So
and how we can have a conversation.
I've done a little reading about that. I do not know the answer. I just want to really go, I don't know the answer. I think that is the question of the moment. And so my theology says that we are all interconnected, and thus we must all be in relationship. So it is important to be in relationship with people who are different than you. And one of the things that I've been reading lately about that particular relationship is that people who tend to be progressive liberals and people who tend to be conservatives have a different set of values. And it's important to know what those values are, because then you can kind of speak to them. I know my tendency is to just believe we all sort of have the same thing going on and we just have different methods. But I guess that's not really true. And that people who are conservative really, you know, it's about family and loyalty and authority and patriotism. And they see the fabric of all of that sort of failing. So speaking to those values and acknowledging that you recognize them, and then framing your conversation in terms of that because they might not be even aware that that's the value system or what our value system is. So that's the meeting I've been hearing lately about that. So I think people are starting to try to figure that out. But I think the relationship is important. What I know, this is a story from my own life, which was we lived in a neighborhood. We were a two-mom family with a little African-American girl. And there were some neighbors down the street that had a, you know, one man, one woman sticker on the back of their car, and they flew the American flag and, you know, other things that indicated we might have different sets of values. And so we're out, and they're out walking, and my daughter's out on her bike, and she falls, and, like, it's this great community event. Like, they are so kind and so helpful to us, and it was just, like, we really sort of bonded in this kind of little moment of tiny crisis on the road in our neighborhood, and I just feel like people mostly are like that. Like, mostly, like, yeah, they really believe that, but they didn't really think there was anything wrong with my particular family or us. Like, they didn't think we were dangerous or anything. Like, and so I thought, and I learned that they were very kind, actually. But they were scary. I wasn't afraid of them. So I think it's messy. Which is, we care when a little girl falls off of her bicycle and gets hurt. I mean, I think race and things do get in the way of people feeling kind about that, but I think people often do feel kind about that.
On the same subject, I have a very close friend who has started a meetup with the explicit intention of bringing liberals and conservatives together in a sort of a neutral place to find ways to talk, and she facilitates the discussions, and she's working towards exactly these kinds of things, and that was, she said this is her work to make this happen. And she has a whole philosophy behind it and a lot of research behind how she does it, which I'm not that familiar with, but if anybody's interested in getting in touch with her, I would be happy to give you that information.
That's great. That's really great.
Thank you so much, Tracy. That was wonderful. And it got me thinking about when I visited family last year when I was traveling. And I am at great odds with most of my family members of origin. And we don't see each other a lot. But I was visiting with a very evangelical cousin in Wisconsin. And he really wanted to get into discussion about our differences. And I was somehow able to say to him, you know, Glenn, I think that there are so many ways in which we are alike, and the things that we want are so similar. Why not go there? And he said, like what? And I said, well, you know, he had a new granddaughter sitting at the table with us, and I said, you know, here is little Bella, and more to come, and I know that you, like me, would like to see this child grow up in a world where there was enough food, clean water, and no fear of being attacked in her home. And he nodded and said, yeah, that was true. And I said, I believe the only way we differ here is on our approach to how we would like to see these things happen. And he agreed. And from there we went on to talk about childhood and how he and his brother got away with everything and I got away with nothing. And, you know, it was great. It changed the whole tenor of that visit.
That's lovely. It's really lovely.
I want to thank you for articulating something I've been trying to think about for a few months now. It has to do with, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway. But it's not like well, I can't do that because I'm too scared. If you think about it, probably most of the things that have been done by anybody were done by people who were afraid to do them while they were doing them. You know, that's not really that relevant.
And Eleanor Roosevelt, this is one of my favorite quotes, Eleanor Roosevelt also said, most of the great things that happened in the world happened with people who weren't feeling particularly good that day. Which I always love too, because I'm like, oh, I don't have a lot of energy today, I feel sick, maybe getting a cold. And I thought that was pretty profound.
Another thing I thought is that different people are afraid of different things, and what takes a lot of courage for one person to do might be easy for someone else. And like one person might say, well, to have a party to discuss things, that's so trivial, that's so nothing. I would almost rather die. That sounds terrifying to me. And if you had the courage to host a party for different people to discuss their views, I bow down to you. Please do it. And whereas for somebody else, you know, standing in front of a bunch of a room full of people with a microphone would be the end of the world. That's something I can do. That's not scary to me. And so the other thing, besides face your fears, is also play to your strength, because they are somebody else's fears. You're doing something.
Thanks. Back to the fear part. I've been a member of Wolf now for about 7 years, I think, maybe eight. First church I've ever belonged to, first church I've ever attended on any kind of regular basis. And one of the big things that I found here is some safety from a fear, well, two fears. Speaking out, and I practice that here and can do it once in a while. Then I discovered the fear that if I speak out, I won't do it right, and I'll be looked down upon, I'll be rejected, and all this worrying and fussing and attempting to undo what came from the heart because I was so afraid that... So I'm still working on it, but I have looked. And everybody credit for helping me face some of the fears of that I can speak my thoughts and leave it alone from there on. So.
Thank you again, Reverend Jay.